Well, the way it is, I guess, is what you can say. This is as far as you can go with it. And, oh, for crying out loud, did I leave anything out there, baby? Just look around there and see if I dropped something as I came. Yeah, there you got it. There, now hurry up. Just move like you was doing something there. That's just if you, there you go. Right, George, you did it. Well, you know, sometimes I kind of hate to bring it. You remember, Sonny, here a few weeks ago we told you about the chicken that laid the empty eggs up there in Maine? And then we told you about the beaver who was felled by his own tree? And, of course, you know, if there's nothing that the beaver knows, it should be cutting down trees. Well, we have here tonight further proof that it's happening to everything. Now, you probably out there have felt that the hounds of hell were nipping at your own personal hocks and nobody else. You figured that, as a matter of fact, this is one of the great delusions that has occurred to... I suspect that one day, 1,000 years or so from now, when they look back at our time, they're going to say that was the one time in man's history when everybody figured that the reason stuff wasn't working out, it was because somebody was flubbing the dub. Well, of course, man years ago didn't fall for that line, and I suspect that years from now, man won't fall for it. Now, but it's only now, you see. Are there any phony detectors with us tonight who know a good and right really, like, why it's happening? Well, let me tell you what happened in Philadelphia, in case you're interested. They got a snake in Philadelphia called the Gaboon Viper. Now, the Gaboon Viper, actually, Bob, is one of the nastiest of all poisonous snakes. He's a nasty son of a gun. And he's notorious for being somewhat deadly. Well, the other day, one of the keepers recently found the Gaboon Viper, which was a prize of the Philadelphia Zoo, they found the Gaboon Viper dead. Its fangs were embedded up to the hilt in its own back. And the head man there at the zoo, Mr. Conant, says, I don't know why he did it. He says, Gaboon Vipers are ill-natured creatures. They don't like other snakes, I know that. They don't like people. And apparently they don't like themselves even now. But actually, I can't tell you why he went and did it. Seemed to have a fairly decent family life. Everything was working out pretty good. We'd just given him a pear, and he'd enjoyed a nice meal of lettuce not more than 20 minutes before that. But of course, there's a lesson in that to all of us, I suppose. I suspect one day, man, the deadliest of all creatures, is going to be found with his fangs embedded in his own fat you-know-what. Yeah, goes around biting his own, and of course it's true that like the Gaboon Viper, we don't like other people. But we don't, there on the other hand, we all had a nice meal just a few weeks ago. I suspect when we all go, it'll be just after a big Thanksgiving celebration, as a matter of fact. Well, I don't know. I just thought you ought to know that things are, of course, then on the, hold it there for crying out loud, all this yelling and hollering. Now, the idea of a Gaboon Viper being found with his fangs embedded in his own back contains indeed a lesson for all of us. Now, man has often felt that he's the only one that truly flubs the dub and doesn't quite make the scene. I suspect that the condition of life itself is not making the scene. Because maybe in the end there is no scene to be made. Wouldn't that fry your cork? We can't take that. I mean, because the old dream, the old illusion, you know, you sit here on the pier with your cork in there a-bobbing, bullheads a-nibbling, you figure any minute now you're going to catch the big one. I mean the big one. We have here tonight a case, another one of those animals out there. This is a case of a dog. Now, you figure that on account of the fact you've got a bad knee, and you were born either 5 minutes too soon or 10 minutes too late, that you might have made the scene. You know, I had a kid the other day stop me. I'm going to tell you a fascinating thing about believing you were either too late or too early for something. I was out of college here a couple of months ago, And a kid came up to me and he says, Shepherd, you were lucky. You were born during a time when there was a real war. I mean, one thing about it is that you guys who were born a couple of years ago, you had a real war. You were lucky. Yeah, lucky. All right, George, I didn't realize how lucky I was, you know. There's nothing more soothing to the ears of a man who wants to know just where he stands in time and place than the sound of a flamethrower in the middle distance. Yeah, well, of course, then again, on the other hand, if your entire world, I suspect that the entire world of almost everybody today is made up almost exclusively of old movies, bad plays, worse books, and a few cab rides. And upon that evidence, they will then produce their own bad play, bad movie, or bad book about what the world is doing and how it should be doing and why it's not quite making it. In fact, the other day I had the chance to talk to a famous satirist. He's famous for political cartoons. And I put it to him right point blank. I said to him, do you really think you know more about the Cuban situation than Dean Rusk? Do you really think you have more information at your fingertips than the CIA? And he said, no. I said, but then why do you figure that you can come up with such a great solution to it? He says, well, I have my artistic license. It's too bad, you know. Speaking of dogs and Flub and the Dub, there's a piece from Dinsmore, California. A picture of a beagle. Now, I don't know whether you know anything about beagles or not, but beagles are dogs that fade almost, you can see it. It looks right out of their eyes. They suspect the worst. They do. And yet, being dogs, they don't quite know what to do about it. Well, here's this beagle. He's been to the veterinarian 12 times in 5 years. His master says Rudy, his name is Rudy, is a good hunting dog, but once he leaped high as the ducks flew over and caught part of a shotgun blast from his owner's gun. Well, that was just the beginning of Rudy's career. Another time, while tethered in a pickup truck on a hunting trip, he jumped or fell out and then ran the pads off his feet trying to keep up with the truck for over 17 miles. He has broken his tail twice, once from falling off an ironing board on which he was sleeping after watching a television show. He's been shot twice merely because he was going in directions where he shouldn't have been going at the time the shooting was going on. And one time he was caught in a rabbit trap where he stayed for a day and a half. And he had a fight which cost him 28 stitches in one leg. Oh, and there was an emergency tonsillectomy that he had one time. Developed a bad case of tonsils. And he had a double header there at that time. He also had a slight case of distemper, which they cured him of. He is now recovering from an abdominal operation. He ate too much of an elderly dead squirrel. It was dead too long. And his manager and his owner says, we keep him for two reasons. One, he's pretty good. Flubs around a lot. But we also consider him an investment. I suspect that's one of the things that keeps us going. We've got too much of an investment, you know? I've often wondered, of course, you know, speaking of investments, I'm really sure. I was listening here over the weekend to a lot of, you're curious about this phase of life. I'm curious about the great pop culture. You know what I mean by the pop culture, Bob? Well, yeah, you know, it's the stuff, it's the people who listen to pop music and who take it seriously. You know those people? And who really get involved in half-hour family situation TV shows. Who really get worried about what's going to happen to Robert Cummings after the commercial. You know, and the people who really get involved in George Maharis. That's a fascinating crew, it really is. The people who really feel for young Dr. Kildare and all those teeth and all that hair. It really do. That's a fascinating world out there. I'm curious about those people. Of course, I suspect they're all either in their trundle bed now at this point, or they're all watching a beer commercial on the Tonight Show. I figure which. well, I'm listening to you hear a lot of it, you see. If you pull back and you listen to, say, it's the kind of people, it's like all those women who really want to see Doris Day keep her virtue and who really believe she's got it. Just makes it even more interesting, that crew. Speaking of virtue, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. Makes you wonder whether it has it. While we're on the subject of that pop culture, though, you listen to the radio and you go up and down, and there's a new development, of course, and that is the non-personal personality. You know, personalities used to be individual. In other words, shepherd to shepherd, you know. He's not John Gambling. He's not Arthur Godfrey. He's Shepherd. But now there's a new development on the radio, Bob, and that is the non-personal personality. It's a fascinating crew. Like you'll have dozens of radio stations today across the country, and they'll call themselves the four fatheads. And see, they'll have four disc jockeys who are on all day long, and they'll call themselves fathead number one, fathead number two, fathead number three, and fathead, and they all sound exactly the same. Exactly the same. You cannot tell them one from the other. There are at least five situations like that developing here in New York. The good guys. and it's an example, I suppose, of, again, the total autonomization of the world we live in. It's almost impossible, what with the echo chambers and the names, for people who are involved in pop culture to tell one of their heroes from the other. I defy any of you to tell Frankie Avalon from Fabian. They're all exactly alike. And the echo chamber is the same. And they say the same things continually. And apparently they wear all the same clothing. I've been on several shows with them. And they must have a uniform place where they go and get the suit. And they have all a very interesting thing that's happening to our world. It's the non-personal personality. Well, that's only part of it. I'm curious, though, not so much about the personalities, but about the people who inhabit that world as spectators. To me, they're really intriguing. And there are three words, key words, in that world that are repeated over and over and over again in their songs, in their movies, and I presume their literature, although it's difficult to call literature. I don't know what the literature would be. I suppose it's the new visual literature. I guess True Stories has gone underground and has become a half-hour TV show. I guess the literature of that group would be the TV shows. That's when they're getting very serious. When they're watching Naked City, they're watching that's their serious time. After it's an intriguing world. Now, there are three words. One word is, of course, love. This is the great elixir under whose banner, I should say, probably more literary and dramatic sins have been committed in the past 50 years than all other would-be causes combined. I mean, all of them combined. The word love is the true elixir. Whenever a playwright is hung up for a solution, he has somebody give a speech about love in the third act, about how it would have cured it all from the beginning. You know that this guy is plowing an arid field. He's way out there where the radishes used to grow strong and heavy, but now there's nothing but a few cockroaches working that territory, so he has to come up with the love speech, and that's enough. You know, the curtain comes down, and you've had the message. Speaking of the love speech, did you know that the new Conrad Hilton Hotel here in town, It doesn't call it suites, just suites. They call it the hospitality suites. They're hospitality suites. And I kind of like, oh, yes, that's very nice, hospitality suites. And they're named after, the various suites are named after different authors. So you can get a suite that's the F. Scott Fitzgerald suite. Now, the whole idea is that the decor of the room or the suite reflects the author. I suppose there's a lot of cigarette butts and empty glasses in the Fitzgerald suite. And a couple of old nylon stockings under the desk, you know, and that heavy Theda Bara perfume, I'm sure. And they have a Don Marquis suite. Well, if you know anything about Don Marquis, yeah, the place is lousy, probably with bugs, cockroaches, and a couple of dead cats are behind the radiator there, and a lot of old rolled up newspapers, and there's a spittoon in the corner if it's a Don Marquis suite. I mean, they're talking about Marquis. And they have these various things. Now I'm not sure. Of course, love has come into the picture in a way, in that sense, that there are several hotels now. Now these are hotels that build themselves as hotels that really love people. Now that's kind of interesting to be loved by a building. I remember a chick one time was described once, the chick I used to go out with, as being, she was built like a building. It was a very small building, but. She didn't have much love, but she had a lot of other stuff going, so I suppose it doesn't matter really in the end. I mean, you take small potatoes and do what you will with them, you know. But on the other hand, the problem, you know, multiplies itself. Now, there's a magazine. You see, what I'm discussing here is that people have lessened in value as love objects, and great corporations themselves have become people, literally. Now, all of you know, there's one magazine that has currently an ad. And it says, it shows Grandma sitting there, you see, and she's saying, "Well, daughter, I'd like to tell you now how you put up the tomatoes." And it shows lovely old Granny sitting there. And the next picture, it shows the Young Modern. Well, you know the Young Modern. The Young Modern spends most of her time making the trip between the supermarket and the newest Albee play and modeling maternity clothes for Vogue. Now, this is the Young Modern. And there she is. She's got that young modern look, you know, that very. And you can see she wears glasses just for fun. She's got her glasses on that she takes out of her purse that she puts on for the fun time because they're way down at the tip of her nose. This is the newest cutie pie thing among models, is they have fun glasses which you put way down. You know, you look right over them, which means that actually underneath it all, I'm Doris Day under these glasses. Well, so she has these glasses hanging down at the end of her nose, and it says, "But then along came Whoopi Day," the new magazine. You see, it says, "There was once when we needed grandmothers, but then came Whoopi Day." And then the next picture, it says, "Yes, but Whoopi Day now takes over where grandmothers left off. But one thing you never did with, that you did with grandmother, that you don't do with Whoopi Day, you don't throw it out." Who passes along grandmother? Well, now, the point being here, it's quite obvious that in the minds of people who publish the new... This is particularly true among lady magazines. Now, there are several types of lady magazines. Of course, there's McCall's, and there's 17, and there's Playboy. And these magazines all look upon themselves as a single person talking to you and existing for you. And if you're not making it down there in the garage, at least Playboy will do it for you in its pad over on Lexington Avenue in the 50s or wherever it is that the Playboy image lives. You see, that man, that Playboy person there, or where Miss, Mrs. Miss, what is the McCall person? Is it a Miss or Mrs.? It's just the McCall person. You know what I'm saying here? This great individual here that stands over us that is the magazine. And, of course, 17 has another tack. 17 has a picture of this girl, you know, this young chick. It says, "Yes, she's loved by everybody." It says, the darling of everyone. It shows a 17-year-old. She's loved by everybody. Everybody loves her. The cop on the beat, and they have this whole business about who loves the 17. She says, and it's she, however, loves us. So that's the difference. And because she loves us, she responds to us. That means she lays the dough on the line. So the fascinating thing here now, you have radio stations now that are billing themselves as people too, you know. Oh, yes. Well, we in a way do that. We like to call ourselves in moments of ill-conceived togetherness, occasionally in the morning, you'll hear Carl, who's in the next room there, you'll hear him say the family station. Well, now, I don't know what kind of family WOR aims at, but I know some pretty swinging families who from time to time have dropped in at this part of the dial. Drunken bums reeling up and down, hitting each other with bottles at 4 o'clock in the morning, getting thrown out, and leases getting busted. But then again, that's another problem, because we sidestep this. Always sidestep it, because we don't want to get involved. Oh, yes, love. Well, that's only the first word that is the, let's say, one of the key words of the trinity of sacred phrases that fit into this great pop culture. Love is the first one. The second word that pops up almost equally, it's usually used with love. The second word is dream. The word dream over and over and over repeats itself in the pop culture. Now, the dream, of course, is to find love. So you see, these words often are very incestuous. One lives off the other, and you wind up with, really, in a sense, they're all one big word. But the dream, the dream continually. So if you're going to write anything for the pop culture, you've got to use those two words. In fact, you'll notice how many of the songs begin with, "I dreamed I loved you." All right, so there you start right out that way. Now, the other great word. Of course, this last word has maybe five or six different sub-words, all of which mean the same thing. And the last great word in the pop culture is sorrow. Now, I am sorry I dreamed last night that I loved you. Now, there you have all three of them together. You see, now that means that the guy who lives in pop culture isn't making it, but he dreamed about loving this person. Now, all of these songs, of course, are variations in one way or another of this. Now, when I say songs, that's also true of all the other elements of pop culture. Not only the songs, the TV shows contain that element endlessly repeated over and over again. They'll act it out. Fabian will show up on the screen in the first reel, and he will meet the girl he loves. He will discuss with her his dream, coupling it with love. And then just before the second commercial, he will lose the girl, and we will see on his expressive features the flickering of pop culture type sorrow, which resembles vaguely a sort of mute simpering. And then in the last scene, of course, it will all be resolved. The dream will become true. I will now love you, and sorrow goes. And that's the resolution of usually each one of these various elements of pop culture. Now, what really intrigues me is not so much, we know this, all the things I'm saying are highly obvious. I'm not discussing this obvious. We're just laying down the groundwork here of something that gets deeper. Now, I'm curious about the people who accept these things as reality. Now, the songs, in short, who relate to this in such a way that it seems to have meaning in their lives. I'm just curious about those people, and I wonder why they're allowed the vote. It's just a leading question, I'm sure, but nevertheless, they are, and they always will be allowed the vote. Now, I've been listening to some of this over the weekend, just listening, in fact, quite a lot of it, just as a kind of a thing. I was curious about this. And another thing about the pop culture is that there is always a belief you'll hear in every one of the disc jockeys who are part of this pop culture. You will, and also part of the magazine pop culture, that this week is better than last week. This is also very, very much part of that world. In short, this week's hit tune is obviously better than last week's. Or this week's television show finally gets there. Next season will be a really good season on ABC. You follow what I'm saying here? that this movie is finally the greatest achievement of Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston doesn't play God in this movie, friends. Charlton Heston has finally done it. He has really become God in this movie, friends. This is the greatest achievement. I wonder how many movies I have heard billed in the last 10 years as the final summation achievement of our generation, using the hour in the cinematic sense. You've heard this 100 times, Bob. The ads come on. Once in a generation, a movie is arrived at that finally... And so on, you see. And of course, every season there is one movie that is known as the gigantic end-it-all blockbuster of all movies that was finally nominated for over 722 Academy Awards, including the Best Popcorn Award. And this is the one, the final gigantic movie. I'm seriously waiting for the day when one movie maker finally takes it by the you-know-what and decides to make a movie that is worth over $4.5 billion, that will take 22 years to complete. Because, you see, the trouble with making a movie that has all the stars in it is that there are new stars that keep coming up before you got your movie finished. You know, what are you going to do when you sign all the stars in sight and you take 6 months to make your movie, and the fourth month, 8 new stars come along? So if you could make a continuing movie to include all the stars as they come along, you see, you could really cover all bases. It will be done. Wait, it will be done. It will be shown in 7 four-hour segments. For all the pop people, I guess the closest to that is The Winter or The Longest Day, which is pop culture applied to the war. I bet a lot of you guys who were in the war never realized, oh, Debbie Reynolds, for heaven's sakes, are you kidding? Debbie Reynolds is part of, it is really a religion. Many people believe more strongly in Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds. Of course, Eddie Fisher is in the case. Interesting philosophical and religious problem there with Fisher. I'm talking about as the pop religion of stars as gods. Believe me, Elizabeth Taylor is more believed in by many people than more formalistic gods. In fact, many people will confuse Elizabeth Taylor for I'm wondering. We're heading into some interesting waters here. Of course, you can't extricate yourself from the fact that man has always tried to live a far richer mythological or artificial life than he has a real life. The difference between these two lives is now becoming very apparent to many people. Few people actually questioned the difference 100 years ago. The mythological life that a man lived a few hundred years ago was generally to be found in his religion. He lived a completely different life. In fact, they called it his religious or his spiritual life. Well, today you have problems. Many parts of the globe, particularly the Western world, because I don't speak much for the Eastern world, but I certainly have seen it in the Western world, religion today in many parts of the Western world, in spite of the fact that it is being professed louder, has become more and more a kind of, it's no longer an operating part of the world. It's more of a, I suppose you might call it a symbolic part. It doesn't operate much. It's more of a, perhaps it could be monumental, which is something else. And believe me, I'm not being anti-religious, so don't immediately start screaming and yelling that that's what I'm being. I'm just merely reporting on the way I see the developments of our time. Now, we can profess religion greatly. We can make a big scene about it. But the more a scene is made about a thing, the more I'm convinced that the less it actually exists. In other words, the more a playwright will write, for example, about love, the more convinced I am that he is incapable of it. The more I see people talk wildly, angrily talk about tolerance and love and one thing and another, the more I'm convinced that those people themselves have trouble making the tolerance-love circuit. I'm sorry. I'd like to believe otherwise. I've met too many of them. I know too many of them. I know too many. You know, who was it recently who did a very interesting thing in connection with that problem? We often consider a playwright or an author as being an exemplar of the views that he presents. In other words, we think because a man is against bad things, he is for good things. That's a very, very, a very dangerous belief to make. Somebody, I can't recall who it was recently, who talked about the difference between, or the constant shift, or war, in the artist. The war between a man who is attempting to get at the truth and public entertainer. What? You don't understand it. Well, there are two elements that go to make up the artist. Public entertainer and man of perception, who is attempting to say what he considers the truth. These two sides are very often at odds. And I'm not talking about guys that show that sell out. In short, a hip comic who purveys the truth will often do a thing purely because it gets a laugh. And what he does then will be hailed as a great element of truth. In fact, I'd like to do a whole series of shows some night on that. It's a very interesting problem. It might seem very theoretical to you, but it is not at all theoretical. As a matter of fact, I know of one comic's work who was recently at length quoted in the Village Voice. Well, I know about the particular bit which was quoted, which was almost an unbelievable example of sophistry in action. Bad logic, but it was treated by the reviewer as an example of tremendous truth. Whereas, as a matter of fact, I know the actual situation surrounding the creation of that particular bit. It was done purely for a laugh. And then when the entertainer found that people were taking it seriously, he didn't disabuse them of the idea. He just let it go because, in short, a man will often just do something to entertain the public, and then it will be hailed later on as an example of great truth. And unfortunately, we're always being confronted with that an artist painting a picture will often paint something purely for amusement and suddenly found that he's created a movement. And then he will apply to it tremendous aesthetic jazz. He'll make a big deal about it. Speaking of big deals, you got the thing in there? Yeah. All righty.
When Buick introduced the Riviera last fall,
Speaking of fiction, we have with us the Paper Book Gallery down on 399 6th Avenue, just this dream and this myth. I'm sorry if I'm getting probably too far afield here, but I'm very interested let's take, for example, the cartoonist who does a cartoon on, let's say, the Cuban situation. Does he really believe that way? In almost every case, he does believe that way. But does he do the cartoon to get a laugh, or does he do the cartoon because he believes that way? Or, and the third alternative, does he prefer not to know the truth about the Cuban situation so that it will enable him to do more cartoons about it? Now, that's a very difficult problem. In other words, does a guy, for example, like Norman Mailer, really read news about, let's say, the Cuban situation or the world situation, and then make statements about it? Or does he merely prefer not to read about it and just hear about an event and then have a great emotional outburst about it, which would make it much easier? Facts always are troublesome, very, very difficult things to deal with. it makes it, in the end, a problem to be so didactic and black and white about everything if you are going to involve yourself with facts. So you will find that most people today who are working in the field of satire rarely deal in facts, because facts keep confusing the issue. Really do. I'm just asking questions here about that. You know, there is another kind of thing, too, that's beginning to develop in our world that I think should have a couple of good airings, too. I'm not talking about the American world. I'm just talking about the world in general. And that is a new kind of anarchism, which is no longer the old traditional anarchism, which is the anarchism of idealism, but it's the anarchism of hate, masquerading under the anarchism of sensitivity. It's a very different kind of anarchism. In short, the guy who's against everything, because he merely defines everything as rotten, because it's oppressing him, and in many ways is merely against life itself, because life itself has turned out to be a disappointment to him, or to large numbers of people. In short, it's anarchy of total destruction, which can often be read as the anarchy of truth. Or sensitivity, because all of us, you know, have a vague death wish. Are you aware of that? That whenever you say to somebody, it's all rotten, and so on, in many subtle ways, you will gain an audience. Because everyone vaguely believes it. And yet it has very little bearing on existence itself. There it is. It's out there. Life is there. People have always died, you know. They died 1,000 years ago. Guys 10,000 years ago probably felt they weren't loved. But you see, in those days, people accepted that as just part of life. Today, we like to feel that if we're not loved, it's because somebody has loused up. Somebody is not giving me what I am due. Love. Somebody said, that rotten government. That confounded, insane American society with its idiotic mores. They'd love me if they had better mores and better ideals. They'd know what true beauty is.
This is...